while Charles was posted to Virginia shortly thereafter. Theirs was an acquaintance of only a few months, and it is not known if he kept in touch with Tubman after she returned to Auburn. Nelson was honorably discharged from the Army in November 1865 at Brownsville, Texas, and he made his way to Auburn, arriving in upstate New York in the winter of 1866-67. Now using the name Nelson Davis, the 22-year-old moved into Tubman's home on South Street, presumably to convalesce during a bout of tuberculosis. But he seems to have remained in her home even after he recovered. Davis found work as a bricklayer and became a boarder in Tubman's expanding household. Despite his ill health, the veteran was described as a tall, strapping man. Davis surely would have sympathized with Harriet in the fall of 1867 when she learned that John Tubman had been gunned down in the streets of Cambridge. Once she was a widow in the eyes of God, she was finally willing to entertain the possibility of remarriage. Sometime in the next 15 months, Nelson and Harriet decided to wed. It was doubtless satisfying to Tubman that both of her parents, now extremely elderly, as well as at least one brother and several other kin, were together to help her celebrate this joyous event. Tubman would have been pleased at the contrast between her first unrecorded marriage ceremony while a slave and her second wedding in a prominent church with local dignitaries as well as family members in attendance. On March 18, 1869, the Reverend Henry Fowler married the couple at Auburn's Central Presbyterian Church. At the time, Davis was only 25, and Harriet was at least 20 years older, if not twice the groom's age. The age difference may appear striking, but was perhaps negligible upon meeting them in person. Census data and photographs suggest that they looked to be much closer in age. In the 1870 census, Davis was identified as 40 years old, although he was not yet 30, and Harriet was likewise listed as 40, although she was older. In 1880, Davis was again listed as 40, perhaps aging very well as a married man. In this same census, Harriet was identified as being 44, although by this time she was well over 50. By all accounts, the difference in their ages was insignificant to them. The wedding announcement in the Auburn Morning News misidentified the groom as William Nelson. He used the name Charles Nelson Davis on the church marriage registry, but he was known to the townspeople as Nelson Davis, and afterward, in local newspaper articles, the name Davis often was attached to the more famous name of Harriet Tubman, by which the bride continued to be known. But Mrs. Davis was also used, a post-war gesture of goodwill toward this respected woman. African Americans were too often dismissed as auntie in person and in the press. Thus, Mrs. Harriet Davis signaled the esteem Tubman elicited among whites as well as blacks. These name changes seemed inconsequential compared with the real transformation that the ceremony symbolized. A reporter at the wedding wrote, "The audience was large, consisting of the friends of the parties and a large number of first families in the city. Ladies and gentlemen who were interested in Harriet, and who for years had advised and assisted her, came to see her married. After the ceremony, Reverend Mr. Fowler made some very touching and happy allusions to their past trials, and apparently plain sailing the parties now had. When the ceremony ended amid the congratulations of the assembly, and the happy couple were duly embarked on the journey of life." This journey of life was certainly one she had long anticipated. To be married and have a home and a large circle of family and friends within her community. One of Tubman's descendants lumped John Tubman and Nelson Davis together, calling them both colorless creatures. Yet the union between Harriet Tubman and Nelson Davis was longer and had a much happier outcome than Harriet's first marriage. Tubman and Davis were married for nearly 20 years. Harriet and Nelson lived quietly in her house on South Street, surrounded by her parents and other family. One of her grandnephews, Harkless Bowley, visiting from Maryland, remembered his great-grandfather Ben with delight. Harkless's grandmother was one of Harriet's disappeared sisters. Her grandson was born free in Canada. After the war, Harkless's mother, Mary Ann, a former fugitive slave, was able to return to both her Maryland birthplace and her former name, Kizzy, Keziah. Family reunions, however marred by those missing, must have been satisfying accomplishments for Tubman. Harriet and her husband had much to be grateful for, yet still they struggled. Money was chronically short, and Tubman was always making solicitations for charity cases. Once, when she requested a contribution for Southern Freedmen from William Seward, he told her, "You have worked for others long enough. If you ask for a donation for yourself, I will give it to you, but I will not help you to rob yourself for others." Despite Seward's advice, Tubman never gave up, continually making appeals for freedmen's schools, for the Salvation Army, and for her church, the AME Zion Church on Parker Street. Seward remained a supporter and advisor to Harriet on his visits home. The loss of his wife in 1865 and the death of his 22-year-old daughter, Frances, the following year, were terrible sorrows for the Secretary of State to shoulder. His own demise at the age of 71 in 1872 was a blow to Auburn. The loss of the town's most celebrated native son was deeply mourned. The massive funeral preoccupied the county and was recounted at length in the press. Just before the coffin was to be closed, a woman, black as night, stole quietly in and, laying a wreath of field flowers on his feet, as quietly glided out again. This was the simple tribute of our sable friend and her last token of love and gratitude to her kind protector. Harriet had paid her last respects to her longtime patron. Tubman's financial worries multiplied after Seward's death. Although the Seward family forgave other debts, she had to pay off her mortgage to settle Seward's estate. On May 29, 1873, Frederick Seward, William's son and executor, collected $1,200 from Tubman. Although she now owned, free and clear, her South Street home on 7 acres, her savings were gone. Her household was overflowing with charity cases, and she had barely enough money to get by. Her financial woes allowed Tubman to become prey to a criminal swindle in 1873. The gold scam was all too common during the post-war era. In late September 1873, a pair of black men appeared in Auburn and first approached Harriet Tubman's brother, John Henry Seward, with a proposition. They would give him a trunk full of gold, coins worth $5,000 smuggled north from South Carolina, in exchange for $2,000 in greenbacks. These con artists explained that they could not be seen with the gold, as all coin belonged to the government, whose agents would seize it. Although Tubman was described as shrewd by most people who knew her, sadly, these men were able to con her. Tubman had been in Beaufort when gold and silver had been hidden away by wealthy whites in the surrounding countryside during Union invasion. She knew firsthand that African Americans were frequently the ones on shovel detail, and they might well have been able to locate slaveholders' hidden valuables before whites themselves made it back to recover buried treasures. So to Tubman, the men's story was not so far-fetched. Eventually, one of Tubman's longtime friends, merchant and Republican politician Anthony Scheimer, furnished her with $2,000 in greenbacks. He expected to be given, in exchange, the same amount in gold, which would realize a handsome profit. Not surprisingly, the trade of paper for coin was to take place during the cover of night. The two con men were able to separate Harriet from those who had accompanied her, her husband, her brother, Scheimer, and one other white man. After being lured on her own deep into the woods, Harriet was knocked out with chloroform and injured, relieved of her purse, and left bound and gagged. Scheimer was able to rescue Harriet sometime before dawn, but the scoundrels were long gone, as was the money. This episode splashed into the Auburn headlines, created a terrible scandal, and wild rumors blossomed throughout upstate New York. Apparently, 2 years before, these same confidence men had committed a similar fraud along the Canadian border, ironically near St. Catharines. The entire upstate New York community was in an uproar, especially because Tubman had been left to die. She recuperated with her friends, the Howlands, who nursed her back to health. Many commented on Tubman's simplistic approach to matters involving money, her intuition that God would deliver. This hangover from her UGRR days now failed her. Perhaps after years of battling illnesses and struggling for survival, the 48-year-old Tubman had lost some of her sharpness. Whatever the case, the misadventure was a setback. Outraged, local townspeople recognized that Harriet had been preyed upon. They concluded she would never have been involved in such a risky scheme if she had not been so economically vulnerable. Thus, Town Fathers renewed their campaign to get Tubman the financial help she needed. Her government claim seemed to be stuck in the Capitol's bureaucratic entrails. New York Congressman C.S. McDougall, a former Union general, pressed the issue in Congress. Representative Jerry W. Hazleton of Wisconsin, a member of the Committee on War Claims, finally endorsed Bill H.R. 3786, which appeared in 1874 in the official report on the Congressional Record. The whole history of the case establishes conclusively the fact that her services in the various capacities of nurse, scout, and spy were of great service and value to the government, for which no compensation was paid her, beside the support she was furnished. Your committee are of the opinion that she should be paid for these services, and to that end, report back the accompanying bill as a substitute for H.R. 2711, appropriating the sum of $2,000 for services rendered by her to the Union Army as scout, nurse, and spy, and recommend its passage. However, there were thousands of such requests pouring into Congress. Tubman's bill, H.R. 3786, passed the House, but not the Senate. During the years of his marriage to Tubman, Nelson Davis became active in Union veterans' organizations, a member of the Crocker Post of the Grand Army of the Republic, GAR. He shared his wife's religion and was a founding trustee of St. Mark's AME Church in July 1870. He was by his wife's side during the burial of her father in the early 1870s and again when her mother was laid to rest in 1880. Nelson Davis would also be the one to help his wife rebuild their home, purchased from Seward, after it was destroyed by a fire in 1886. He did extensive repair work by replacing the original wooden structure with a largely brick one, still standing in Auburn today. Davis would encourage his wife in her philanthropic endeavors. Her dream of building a charity home adjacent to their South Street house was thwarted by their constant lack of funds, but her benevolence made Tubman the pride of the town. In 1873, the Auburn paper identified her as the celebrated colored philanthropist. One of the white ladies of Auburn who would empty her pantry for Tubman's cause recalled, "All these years her doors have been open to the needy, the aged, the babe deserted, the demented, the epileptic, the blind, the paralyzed, the consumptive, all have found shelter and welcome. At no one time can I recall the little home to have sheltered less than 6 or 8 wrecks of humanity, entirely dependent upon Harriet for their all." In a photograph taken at Harriet's South Street home, circa 1885, 6 African Americans, besides Harriet and Nelson, are identified as household residents. Harriet is standing in the back row, next to Gertie Davis Watson and 3 children, Lee Cheney, Walter Green, and Doris Stewart, Tubman's grandniece. Seated in front are Nelson Davis, smoking a pipe, Pop Alexander, and blind Auntie Parker. By this time, Harriet's favorite, her adopted daughter, Margaret, had married Henry Lucas, a local caterer, and moved out. But she would bring her own children to Harriet's house for long afternoons, filled with stories and reminiscences. Margaret's youngest daughter, Alice, fondly remembered her frequent visits to the South Street home. Once, while she was playing in the long grass, Alice was taken by surprise when her great aunt suddenly popped up in the meadow beside her. Harriet had left her rocking chair, flattened herself against the ground, and silently slithered up to the little girl to surprise her, a trick she had learned from her days with the Underground Railroad. Tubman kept her household filled with family, but also with strangers who needed her support. This hospitality was critical for the friendless of her race, who were elderly, because few, if any, of the homes for the aged between Auburn and Greater New York City, admit colored people. With her husband's failing health in 1886, Tubman decided she must renew her appeal for government subsidy. Veterans' pensions were being lavishly dispensed during this period. Indeed, Ohio Congressman Benjamin Harrison, who would serve as Republican president from 1889 to 1893, himself a Civil War veteran, had been criticized for sponsoring so many private bills to benefit veterans, even for some, it was later discovered, who had been declared deserters. In January 1887, Tubman was granted permission to withdraw the papers submitted to Congress in 1874 on behalf of her private bill. These documents were sent to Philip Wright of Medford, Massachusetts, who advised, "If I knew anybody in authority, I should try to do something for you about getting you your pension. Unfortunately, I do not. The petition for a pension should properly come from a representative from New York." By the late 1880s, Tubman's reluctance to reveal the severity of her circumstances spurred the ladies of Auburn to devise a system whereby their servants would deliver baskets of food to the porch of Tubman's South Street home, anonymous donations to help her out. She might wake up with the cupboard bare, wondering how to provide for the motley group collected under her roof, and discover a bounty on her front steps when she opened her door. When Theodora Pomeroy, a former mayor, prominent legislator, and great friend of the Seward's, died in 1905, Harriet paid a mourning call at the Pomeroy home. There she was cordially received by all the members of the family, the younger ones she had rocked and tended in infancy, the newspaper commented. She was given a place of honor in the funeral cortege, and the family carriage took her home. Apparently, there were several prominent families in Auburn who had employed Tubman at one time or another in a domestic capacity, most likely as child tender. This kind of work, which completely dominated opportunities for black female wage earners during this era, seems to have been the exception rather than the rule for Harriet while in Auburn. Serving as a children's nurse for the Pomeroys was perhaps undertaken only as a means of securing continued patronage by Auburn's elite, whose favor Tubman required, or she may have been forced into this domestic role when she lost her husband's income, first due to his illness, and then finally his death. Harriet Tubman buried Nelson Davis, her husband of 19 years, at Fort Hill Cemetery in October 1888. Her brother, John Henry Stewart, a teamster in Auburn, who also resided on South Street, died the next year. Tubman must have felt considerably alone once again. In June 1890, Congress passed a law providing for widows of war veterans to receive modest payments. Tubman applied for the $8 per month available. Her application offered a number of facts to which she swore, including her birth year, as 1825. But Tubman's pension application was returned to her with specific queries about her claim. For example, the government requested some proof about the true identity of Nelson Davis. Like many ex-slaves, black veterans and their relatives found their appeals challenged or rejected because of mix-ups concerning slave names and free names. In May of 1892, Tubman tried to clear up the matter with another round of documentation. She offered a new deposition and swore again that she was born in 1825. Tubman confirmed the name of her late husband of nearly 20 years was Nelson Davis, but she explained that in bondage he was known as Nelson Charles. She testified that her husband served in the Union Army and was discharged under the name of Nelson Charles, but by the time he settled in Auburn in 1866, he had taken the name Nelson Davis. When he married, he used a combination of names, Charles Nelson Davis. In her statement, Tubman positively and unequivocally swears that Nelson Davis, who was married under the name Charles Nelson Davis and who died as Nelson Davis, was the identical person who served in Company G, 8th USC Infantry, as Nelson Charles. She supplied a church marriage certificate and provided affidavits for two witnesses. One was Maggie Lucas, who confirmed Davis's identity. These deposed witnesses testified that Harriet and Nelson's was a proper and legal union, that Davis had no other wife, and so on. Finally, Harriet was able to prove her case, and by the end of 1892, she was granted her monthly widow's pension of $8. Not only was this the first time Tubman had secured government support since the war, but it was the first time in her entire life that she had any reliable income. Although it was a very small sum, this lifetime pension represented some measure of security to Harriet, who had spent such a hardscrabble life. Many would have expected Harriet Tubman to savor the moment. She owned her own home, and now had a small but steady income to maintain her household. She was nearly 70 years old and had surely earned the right to retire from the challenging pace she had undertaken since her return from war. But this was never Tubman's style. She steadfastly held on to her dream, to establish a separate charitable institution in Auburn for the needy and neglected of her race. She surveyed an enviable parcel of land from her porch. She coveted a large 10-room brick building next door, with another plain house nearby. Both structures were surrounded by smaller outbuildings. One observer commented that this property, in many respects, reminded her of a picturesque southern setting, with a big house, an overseer's cottage, and slave cabins. Purchasing this 25-acre lot would quadruple Tubman's real estate holdings, but also saddle her with debt. Yet the acquisition of this parcel and its buildings could move her closer to her lifelong objective of creating a permanent charity home. Although a small circle knew of her ambitions, most townsfolk were taken aback when Tubman showed up at a public auction in 1896 and bought 130 South Street. The property, known as the Old Beardsley Estate, had once belonged to Seward's father-in-law, and in 1864 was sold for over $2,000. When the estate came back on the market, Tubman made a winning bid of $1,450. Tubman contacted elders of the AME Zion Church and persuaded them to help her secure a bank mortgage for $1,000 and to raise funds for the remaining sum to provide a down payment. An AME Zion minister, Reverend G.C. Carter, took on this cause, and in a little over a week, donations funded the down payment for the project so Tubman could expand her charity for Auburn's needy. Her leap of faith in buying this property shamed fellow citizens into yet another push to secure Tubman money for her own post-war government claim. An article appeared in July 1896 in the Chautauquan that chided, "It seems strange that one who has done so much for her country and been in the thick of the battles with shots falling all about her should never have had recognition from the government in any substantial way." Harriet often echoed this lament. "You wouldn't think that after I served the flag so faithfully, I should come to want under its folds." Prominent Republicans offered to lead the charge once again. In 1897, a petition requesting that Congressman Cyrano E. Payne of New York bring up the matter again and press it to a final and successful termination was circulated and endorsed by Auburn's most influential citizens. This appeal included signatures from the Garrisons, Sedgwicks, and other prominent upstate and New England families. An affidavit from Tubman and other supporting documents were sent along with a petition to Washington. Payne's first gambit was a request for review by the Committee on Invalid Pensions, as the chair of the committee was his fellow delegate from New York, George Ray. Payne hoped a straightforward soldier's pension could be obtained on the basis of Tubman's war record. The inquiry omitted any reference to the issue of back wages, just a simple pension request. Payne's new bill proposed that Congress grant Tubman a military pension of $25 per month, the exact amount received by surviving soldiers. A staff member of the National Archives, later researching background on this claim, pinpointed problems with supporting documentation. No extant evidence in government records supported Tubman's persistent claim that she had been working under the direction of the Secretary of War. The archivist conceded that Tubman might have been a confidential agent of the Department of State, or of Secretary Seward, rather than of the War Department, but cautioned, "The records which we have received from the Department of State contain no reference to her. Providing her with funds without any corroborating evidence was a bureaucratic red flag." Some on the committee believed that Tubman's service as a spy and scout, which was supported by valid documentation, justified such a pension. Others suggested that the matter of a soldier's pension should be dropped, as she could more legitimately be pensioned as a nurse. At the same time, $25 was more than double the pension nurses received. One of the members was W. Jasper Talbert of Parksville, South Carolina. Some have suggested this South Carolina politician vindictively tried to block Tubman's pension, that it was a point of honor to his white Southern statesmen that a black woman not be given recognition as a soldier. After all, she was a fugitive slave much of her life, with the high price on her head imposed by Southern magistrates and even the legislature of Maryland. Perhaps a South Carolinian's stubborn resistance was as much a part of war's legacy as was Harriet's unwavering claim. Regardless, a compromise was finally achieved. Tubman's pension as a widow would be increased on account of special circumstances. The House authorized raising the amount to $25, while the Senate amended to lower this to only $20, which was finally passed by both houses and signed into law by President William McKinley in February 1899. After 30 years of struggle, this represented a tremendous victory. First and foremost, details of Tubman's wartime service became part of the congressional record. It was publicly acknowledged that hers was a double claim. Although she may have only been given an increase for her widow's pension, the record asserted that, in view of her personal services to the government, Congress is amply justified in increasing that pension. It must have been with great personal satisfaction that she finally received her due, that her persistence had paid off. She had been committed to Union veterans and had participated with enthusiasm in Grand Army of the Republic veterans' activities, with or without any government pension. When interviewed in 1907, she insisted that the journalist from the New York Herald highlighted her affiliation with the veterans group. She would be bankrolled by pension checks of $240 per year instead of the less than $100 she had been receiving. But even with her increased pension, Harriet, nearing 80, was finding that her ambitions outdistanced her abilities. She felt overwhelmed by the administration of her own and extended households. She was daunted by the burdens associated with her additional charitable property and its residence. One year, she did not have the cash to cover the taxes on her 25-acre parcel and had to surrender cows to pay the debt. In 1903, she decided to donate the property she had purchased at auction to the AME Zion Church, with the stipulation that she would hold a lifetime deed and that the place would be maintained as a home for aged and indigent colored people. In this way, her dream would outlive her. A newly appointed board christened one of the buildings on the grounds John Brown Hall to honor their donor's wishes, but they insisted upon calling their project the Harriet Tubman Home. Although it took 5 more years to raise sufficient funds to properly equip and fully staff the home, there were several residents before the official opening. This feat was only accomplished with the organizing talents of the Board of Lady Managers, the dedicated clubwomen who helped Harriet realize her dream. On June 23, 1908, Tubman was guest of honor at the day-long opening celebration, which included a parade, prayers and speeches, a band concert, a dinner, an evening reception, and a dance. The Harriet Tubman Home became the only charity outside New York City dedicated to the shelter and care of African Americans in the state. The main brick building, John Brown Hall, also known as the John Brown Infirmary, was filled with comfortable furniture, plenty of clean white linen, enameled beds, and surrounded by bountiful orchards. The newspaper recorded, "With the stars and stripes wound about her shoulders, a band playing national airs, and a concourse of members of her race gathered about her to pay tribute to her lifelong struggle on behalf of the colored people of America, aged Harriet Tubman Davis, the Moses of her race, yesterday experienced one of the happiest moments of her life, a period to which she has looked forward for a score of years. The Harriet Tubman Home is today an accomplished fact, and her 95 years have at least been crowned with success." Again, Harriet's age was always a matter of speculation. At this time, she was closer to 85 than 95. She had been hospitalized just the year before, but with the opening of her home, Tubman demonstrated that even at her advanced age, she was both sound and spry. That June afternoon was a glorious one for Tubman. She circulated among the crowds, telling stories to rapt listeners. She made time for those who would lean close to catch her every word, especially the children. This is just one of the dozens of occasions over the years where she spun her stories, tales of the UGRR, daring during the Civil War, meeting and greeting the great men of her day, recounting her unique adventures to an enthralled, mainly white audience. Her quick wit and sharp response charmed the crowds. When she was asked to give a speech to the assembled visitors, Tubman spoke extemporaneously at length and, as always, entertained her listeners. Harriet explained, "I did not take up this work for my own benefit, but for those of my race who need help. The work is now well started, and I know God will raise up others to take care of the future." All knew that this was a landmark occasion, because the dream of Moses for herself and for her people was at last realized. Even with the establishment of the home, there remained battles to wage with its overseers. The fees required by church supervisors disgruntled Tubman. The cost of room and board was $3 a week, or for a fee of $150, a resident was given life privileges. She accepted the church's regulations, but knocked on doors and solicited contributions for those who could not afford these charges. Wealthy patrons, such as the Osborne family, continued to heed Tubman's charitable calls. Although she was officially retired from funding the home that bore her name, she never passed up the opportunity to pry open the pocketbooks of those she visited, offering some story of a forlorn but deserving case to which they might want to contribute. Whenever health permitted, she toured on behalf of the home that bore her name. She was especially pleased when Julia Henderson established a home for colored women on Holyoke Street in Boston and named the facility after her. Tubman was the center of attention and most honored guest at the home's dedication in 1904. Tubman was even more pleased when the world came to her. Over the Christmas holidays in 1903, Harriet had a reunion with Susan B. Anthony. On New Year's Day, Anthony reported with delight that Tubman was still alive. "I saw her the other day at the home of Eliza Wright Osborne, the daughter of Martha C. Wright, in company with Elizabeth Smith Miller, the only daughter of Garrett Smith. Miss Emily Howland, Reverend H. Thaw, and Miss Ella Wright Garrison, the daughter of Martha C. Wright and wife of William Lloyd Garrison, Jr. All of us were visiting at the Osbornes, a real love feast of the few that are left, and here came Harriet Tubman." Tubman's devotion to women's rights was legendary as well. She would always take advantage of reunions with women friends from her abolitionist days, many of whom transferred their considerable energies to fighting for women's rights after slaves were freed. Whenever suffrage advocates gathered in upstate New York, Tubman would grab her shawl and hat and head for the Auburn train station. Friends commented that she rarely concerned herself with the schedule, but simply would make her way to the depot and take the next train going the right direction. On October 23, 1905, Emily Howland and Harriet Tubman shared a train ride to Rochester for a suffrage meeting the next day, but parted upon arrival in Rochester. While Howland spent the night comfortably, Tubman sat up all night at the station, knowing, perhaps by experience, that there would be no lodgings which would take in a woman of color. The next day, when they met up at the conference and Howland discovered how Tubman had spent the night, she was horrified, especially at her own thoughtlessness. First, Howland offered to share her room with Tubman for the duration of the meeting. Second, she confronted convention organizers and pointed out the leadership's responsibility to black delegates, insisting that they provide lodgings for women of color who attended future meetings. It was typical that these kinds of demands for reform came from Tubman's friends, but not from her personally. She was extremely modest and would rarely advance agendas that might be construed as self-promoting. Even when forced to sit up all night in a train station, Tubman's restraint and self-sacrifice were on prominent display. Tubman especially enjoyed offering advice and inspiration when visitors arrived on her doorstep. Perhaps she appreciated a reunion with an old friend she had met during the war, Sojourner Truth, when she spoke at a local friends meeting on August 18, 1878. Booker T. Washington often paid his respects during stopovers in upstate New York. Tubman also became a confidant and friend to some of the most powerful black women leaders of her day. Women's Christian Temperance Union leader, Eliza Peterson of Texarkana, Texas, and Mary Talbert of Buffalo, New York, who became president of the Empire State Federation of Colored Women's Clubs and led a protest of exhibits demeaning to blacks at the 1901 Pan American Exposition. Talbert's club gave Tubman and her home substantial financial support. Tubman enjoyed regaling journalist interviewers such as Frank Davis, whose 1907 Sunday magazine piece in the New York Herald featured a profile of her. In 1911, eminent author James B. Clark published a pamphlet, An Hour with Harriet Tubman, to promote the cause of her charitable home. Clark's tribute suggested, "When her voice is forever stilled, her soul, like the soul of him who she calls her dearest friend, will later be marching on." By this time, Harriet Tubman had slowed her pace, but not her determination, working on behalf of her dream right up until her demise. Following a lengthy hospitalization in 1911, she moved out of her own house and into the charity facility next door. The minister of the AME Zion Church would conduct services there if she was unable to attend Sunday worship. By 1912, although her spirit was still joyful and her faith still abundant, her body was giving out. In November 1912, she summoned a local lawyer and prepared a will. She named three women as heirs: her niece, Mary Gaston, one of her brother John Henry's descendants, her grandniece, Katie Stewart, the adopted daughter of her brother James Isaac, and Frances Smith, the matron of the Harriet Tubman home, to whom she felt indebted for her dedication and personal care. These three would inherit Tubman's personal home and its 7 acres. In early March 1913, Tubman lapsed into a final illness and announced to bedside attendants that she knew she was going to die soon. Friends and family gathered, and notices in local papers, as well as in the New York Times and New York Tribune, notified readers that Harriet Tubman was dying. All praised her work with the Underground Railroad and mentioned her connection to the Civil War. It was as if some grand historic eye were slowly closing. Harriet Tubman had witnessed the burials of Frederick Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison, William Seward, so many of the great statesmen and politicians, all her colleagues in the struggle to free the slaves. She survived the deaths of Civil War comrades, Generals Saxton, Gilmore, and Montgomery, and so many of the officers and soldiers she knew during the war. She outlived several siblings, nieces, and nephews, as well as two husbands. Tubman was clearly ready to die, and all who visited her deathbed described her as a powerful spirit, one who would join in the singing of hymns and felt ready to meet her maker. Shortly before she died, on the evening of March 10, 1913, in loving remembrance, she told the assembled mourners, "I go to prepare a place for you." Epilogue: Harriet Tubman's legacy. In March 1913, Harriet Tubman was buried with military honors in Auburn's Fort Hill Cemetery. A photograph of the event shows a handsome coffin at the gravesite, while black and white mourners crowd around. Shortly after her death, the town of Auburn decided to dedicate a plaque in her honor to be placed on a public building. The town organized such an event a little over a year after Tubman died. The memorial service was held in the midst of a period described as the nadir of American race relations, an era when the gains of Reconstruction were edged out by the losses to Jim Crow. That the town of Auburn would sponsor such a tribute demonstrated Tubman's exalted status within her upstate community. The bronze tablet was funded by the Auburn Businessman's Association and the Cayuga County Historical Society. Booker T. Washington, the most prominent race leader of his day, traveled to upstate New York to make the keynote address. Mary Talbert, a close friend of Tubman's and chair of the board of the National Association of Colored Women, spoke on Tubman's life and work. Alice H. Lucas, listed in the program as Harriet's grandniece, was invited to perform the unveiling. On June 12, 1914, church and civic leaders, black and white alike, convened in a civic auditorium for the dedication ceremonies, as the mayor presided over this historic and integrated event. Tubman was lionized by those who gathered to pay tribute. At the same time, the souvenir program bore a cover quote from Booker T. Washington, which carried his photograph and a 2-page promotion of his Tuskegee Institute inside. Certainly, the Tubman home, still a local Auburn institution, received its due, but the charity was already falling on hard times, and it would close its doors in a little over a decade when the last of 5 remaining residents died. But it was the bronze tablet, meant to herald Tubman's achievement, that most clearly revealed hints of problems to come. It began promisingly. Called the Moses of her people, during the Civil War, with rare courage, she led over 300 Negroes up from slavery to freedom and rendered invaluable service as nurse and spy. But it went on to proclaim, she truthfully said, "On my Underground Railroad, I never ran my train off the track, and I never lost a passenger." The use of dialect on the plaque was creative license, reflecting the way in which white projections and racist shading shaped Negro achievements. In this, As in so many other cases, the alleged authenticity of dialect undermined and overshadowed any purported attempt to convey Tubman's exact words. Such distortions began almost as soon as Tubman was laid to rest and continue well into the present day. Similarly, while she was credited with seeing 300 slaves to freedom as a conductor, those she freed during her service in wartime South Carolina, more than 750 in the Combahee River raid alone, were left uncounted. Trying to untangle the web of misinformation and plumb the rich reservoir of memories associated with Harriet Tubman presents major challenges to her biographers. Those who cherished her while she was alive, and perhaps Tubman herself, would be both pleased and puzzled by current-day efforts to extend her legacy. How would Tubman respond, knowing her name was attached to contemporary hotlines and shelters for fugitive women and children, those who seek protection from abusive spouses? In her former home of Canada, she is associated with a recently opened digitized research facility at York University in Ontario, the Harriet Tubman Resource Center on the African Diaspora. Although the charitable home that bore her name in Boston has long since folded, a life-size group of bronze figures commemorating her role in the Underground Railroad, Step on Board, was recently dedicated in Boston's South End. This monument was the first statue of a woman erected on the city's public grounds. An equally impressive statue of Tubman, larger than life, stands in Battle Creek, Michigan, Sojourner Truth's longtime home. In the Battle Creek representation, Tubman is holding on to a rifle. In her birthplace state of Maryland, plans to paint a billboard-sized portrait of Tubman showing her with a rifle have been stalled. Protests within the state have prevented any public art of Tubman in the familiar guise of handling her Civil War musket. The image has sparked considerable controversy within contemporary debates, issues of political correctness, gun culture, black violence, and feminist heroics all come into play. Lynn Cheney, former head of the National Endowment for the Humanities, 1986-93, led an attack on the national history standards released in 1994. Tubman's name was frequently invoked as an example of flaws associated with the guidelines. After a protracted public debate in which opponents like Cheney railed against political correctness and hammered away at revisionism, these commissioned standards failed to gain congressional approval. Overnight, Tubman's name became a hot button for conservative critics, and she became a symbolic whipping girl for political correctness. Tubman's overlapping legacies and enduring impact within American culture could not be more firmly established. Tubman's mentorship and association with Auburn's Parker Street AME Zion congregation sustained her. For most of her years in Auburn, she was an exuberant enthusiast during church services, shouting in the aisles and stirring up the congregation. She was identified with favorite hymns such as Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. In Maryland, the Basil Methodist Episcopal Church of Dorchester County has hosted summer celebrations to commemorate her life, and the Harriet Tubman Museum of Cambridge hosts an annual event in observance of Harriet Tubman Day, March 10th. Her association with the British Methodist Episcopal Church in St. Catharines, Ontario, merits a double-sided bilingual historical marker in French and English on church grounds, dedicated in 1993. By far, the largest pilgrimage gathers in May in Auburn, New York, on Memorial Day weekend. The AME Zion Church, which still owns both her house and the charity home property, calls together the faithful to celebrate her moral example and legacy. One wonders what Tubman would make of the group's Miss Harriet Tubman contest, in which high school students nominated by their church congregations vie for the title. Surely, the extensive prayer meetings, gospel program, and elaborate meals would be reminiscent of similar celebrations during her lifetime, even if the annual coronation of a teenaged girl is not. Many of her relatives, descendants of nieces and nephews, flock to Auburn to join in the festivities, both at the home and at the gravesite. Two headstones have been erected at Tubman's grave since her burial, the second by the Empire State Federation of Colored Women's Clubs in 1937. After the Harriet Tubman home was abandoned, the remaining structure fell into ruin. In the 1940s, the property was slated for public auction to satisfy back taxes. But due to the efforts of the AME Zion Church, Funds were raised to preserve and partially restore this historic site. Now the Harriet Tubman home is run by its church owners as a house museum and education center. In the 1990s, the church purchased the adjacent property, on which the actual house in which Tubman lived still stands. At present, plans are underway for desperately needed repairs and restoration. Scores of public schools scattered across the country bear Tubman's name, as do at least two additional public buildings. Cambridge, Maryland is the nearest town to Tubman's birthplace, a rural site where a state marker has been placed. Cambridge supports a storefront facility established and maintained by the Harriet Tubman Museum and Educational Center. The museum is a relatively new addition, but the band of volunteers promotes its annual commemoration while offering year-round tours of Tubman sites in Dorchester and, in recent years, a monthly forum for exchange of information about Tubman's world. In May of 2000, a Harriet Tubman Memorial Garden was dedicated along the town's highway, and a pilgrimage from Maryland to upstate New York was conducted. The Cambridge facility is an attempt to involve the local community in preserving a native daughter. This facility now boasts only school children's dioramas and a souvenir shop. Both the Harriet Tubman home in Auburn, New York, and the Harriet Tubman Museum in Cambridge, Maryland, are underfunded and understaffed and reflect the hard times they have endured. But these institutions also reflect the spirit of dedication that embodied Tubman's own life. In Macon, Georgia, a brand new multi-million dollar facility will soon open, yet another museum to honor Tubman. But this museum and its collections have no substantive connection to Harriet Tubman. The founders decided in 1981 to build a cultural center in adjacent abandoned warehouses and named this new venture the Harriet Tubman Center for Spiritual and Cultural Awareness. The original building, 1985 to 2004, displayed Harriet Tubman's name on an exterior plaque, which explained the tribute. Yet visitors would search in vain inside for any information about Tubman. The several exhibits, including one on Macon natives William and Ellen Craft, famed fugitive slaves, made no mention of her at all. The governing board renamed their galleries the Tubman African American Museum and styled themselves as a cultural center for Middle Georgia. While her name is not being taken in vain with these tributes, by being invoked, it will continue to raise the question, who was Harriet Tubman? For countless American blacks living today, Harriet Tubman was not just a mythical figure, but a flesh-and-blood liberator who delivered their ancestors to freedom. There are by now thousands of African Americans whose grandparents or great-grandparents trace their freedom to Tubman. The list of those whose lives were forever changed by her work with the Underground Railroad or Union Army will grow through the generations. Their deliverance was a concrete gift of freedom, as Tubman offered new lives and liberty, not just for those she rescued, but also for their descendants and their descendants' descendants as well. Tubman died the same year that Rosa Parks was born. For the rest of the teens, the 20s, and well into the 30s, Tubman's life fell into literary obscurity. But a biography in 1943 and then, in the 1950s, a handful of books sympathetically re-examined Harriet's life, most notably juvenile biographies by Dorothy Sterling and Ann Petrie. By the 1960s, interest in her accomplishments was reflected in a steady stream of children's books and juvenile novels, six in the 1960s, five in the 1970s, six in the 1980s. In the 1990s, a whopping 21 young adult and picture books were published on Tubman. And with 16 new children's titles appearing between 2000 and 2003, the revival flourishes. But Tubman has been maternalized by her role as one of the most popular heroines of the elementary school set. The true tale of Tubman's career following the North Star by now may have surpassed the folkloric popularity of George Washington's chopping down the cherry tree confession, "I cannot tell a lie," a fabrication dreamed up by Washington biographer Mason Parson Weems. Highlighting Harriet Tubman is not meant to replace George Washington, but to insist that she take her rightful place within the pantheon of American patriots. Generations of American schoolchildren have been treated to performances of Freedom Train and other dramas based on Tubman's life and career, even if these stage productions are sprinkled with inaccuracy. They usually include the essential truths of Tupman's experience as a UGRR conductor, the lessons of following the North Star, of standing up for what is right, that individual actions can change the world, sends a powerful message to America's young people, especially when performed under the banner based on a true story. Tupman cherished her freedom and her citizenship more than most, certainly more than those who had never been in bondage. Besides a commitment to racial justice and a passion for liberty, Tupman preached the power of persistence. Throughout her UGRR career, she offered the following refrain: "If you are tired, keep going. If you are scared, keep going. If you are hungry, keep going. If you want to taste freedom, keep going." Along with the inspirational spirituals for which Moses became so beloved, this motto has been handed down to the present generation as part of her enduring legacy. Born into an age of darkness, an age when America was enthralled to slavery, Harriet Tubman freed herself and was reborn. She renamed her liberated self and hoped to lead others into Canaan as well. This was not because she saw herself as a hero, but because she believed she was doing the Lord's bidding. Not unlike Joan of Arc, with whom she was frequently compared, Harriet Tubman viewed herself as an instrument of God. However, Tubman did not manifest any messianic qualities, nor did she particularly see herself as chosen. She did not trust in fate as much as in the power of prayer and in the individual's ability to seize her own destiny. Tubman embraced a much more universalist view. Each and every person has the light of God within. And just like the song, she was going to let hers shine. In 1868, Frederick Douglass lauded Tubman by lamenting that while his role in the anti-slavery crusade brought him applause and encouragement, "God bless you" has been your only reward. "The midnight sky and the silent stars have been the witness of your devotion to freedom and of your heroism." But history is also a witness to Tubman's heroic deeds and sacrifices along the road to freedom. And although historians may have too long ignored it, her past remains before us, all around us, and urging us, in her own words, "Keep going." This has been a Hachette audio production of Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, written by Catherine Clinton, read by Shayna Small, produced and recorded by Audio Media Production, post-production by Audio Media Production. Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, is also available in print and digital formats from Back Bay Books, Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group, Inc. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2004 by Catherine Clinton. Audio production copyright 2017, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.